Welcome to the Applied Policy Podcast, bringing you up-to-date insights on health policy and reimbursement progress that will improve lives by improving care. I'm Louisa Hart.
I'm William Rogers. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Applied Policy, and I also manage our device vertical.
Bill, as I think I emailed you, I literally don't know where to start with interviewing you, which of your professional experiences I should ask you about first. You have been Chief of Emergency Services in a large veterans healthcare system. You have taken aim at burdensome Medicare practices. And I think was a one-off. You were owner and operator of an excavator company and 5 deployments transporting severely injured troops from Afghanistan, which is so admirable. We'll get to those chapters soon. But what excites you now about your work at Applied Policy and what exactly are you doing?
Well, one of the things that I found most gratifying in emergency medicine was the requirement to sort of figure out a solution to a puzzle quickly, with often incomplete information, and then being prepared to adapt as your treatment led to certain responses, hopefully the ones you sought. But I find that almost happens with what we do at Applied Policy, because our potential client comes to us with an issue, with a problem, with a challenge. They've produced a new medical device or something like that, which could benefit a lot of people. But of course, the availability is very dependent on the reimbursement. And so we're confronted with that problem and then get to know the device better and coming up with a strategy, basically, for getting from the point of no code, no coverage, no payment to the point of an adequate payment and a reasonable set of rules for coverage and getting that product available to Medicare and other insured beneficiaries. So I guess that's the most gratifying thing. And the thing that I really, I feel like is more of a treasure than anything else is that I'm working with a bunch of much younger people because I'm 71 years old and their minds work so fast and their sponges, all of them have gotten really, really smart in the years that I've been working with them and bouncing things off of them and having them challenge things that I say gives me immense intellectual gratification and pleasure.
You worked inside CMS. It was a while ago. Have things changed, or is the essential way of working with CMS the same?
I tell the new employees always, and probably too frequently, the long-term employees, that what you learn working at CMS, and I really had the best job you could possibly have considering where I am now, because my job was sort of to act as an ombudsman for CMS, for clinicians, which broadly is, you know, nurse practitioners, PAs, MDs, DOs, chiropractors, and physical therapists. I walked into that job in 2002, and I'd been managing emergency departments at that point for 11 years. So I knew a lot about what happens when the check arrives in the mailbox, but I didn't know very much about what goes into having that check written. And as an ER doc who'd been practicing emergency medicine for, you know, 12 years and had been running ERs for 10 and had spent 10 years in the back of an ambulance because I volunteered on the local ambulances in my first two jobs, I was really in a good position to present the clinical perspective, which was really important. And nobody else who actually worked at CMS, you know, knew about that.
From what you're saying, I assume that you heard complaints about CMS when you were in your prior position as in emergency medicine. Did you on the front? Were you on the front lines of problems with CMS?
And, you know, I would say to myself all the time, why do they make it so complicated? You know, just pay me so I can pay my emergency physicians. Just that's all I'm asking for. You know, why do we have to write down acute headache for a CAT scan or the CAT scan is going to get denied? Why do we have to measure something that doesn't seem important to that particular presentation? Then when I got to CMS, I spent 14 years saying, wow, I understand why we require this. I understand why we require that. You know, it's unfortunate. It's a tragically cumbersome, complicated process, and it shouldn't be, but there's so much money involved. You know, it just can't be haphazard. So my 14 years at CMS, more and more I realize that as long as we're going to do payment for healthcare the way we do it in this country, it's going to be complicated.
You describe it as complicated. A lot of people describe our healthcare system, specifically the area that you work in, as broken. Is it broken or is it just necessarily complicated?
I don't use the word system and healthcare in the same sentence if I'm talking about the United States. We really don't have a system at all. We have a bunch of steps in the process, for instance, of payment. You know, the clinician does the service, the clinician tries to describe the service, the clinician's coder tries to code it appropriately, the payer tries to not pay for it unless they're convinced that it's good for the patient. And then there's all the issues about investigations and audits, which are enormously expensive and sometimes ruinous to practices, but sometimes very necessary. It's just one inefficiency piled on top of another.
Reading between the lines, you are a guide through that inefficiency, it sounds like, to ensure that your clients get to the end of this maze without taking dead ends or even knowing where the entrance to the maze is.
That's a really good way to describe it, yeah. I think every time we've had a client that we've successfully gotten to the point where they have a code and sufficient payment and appropriate coverage rules, if there are coverage rules, has been a success. And we do that, you know, multiple times a year. If a company comes to us and has a product that they think has benefit, you know, we'll do our best to get them where they need to be to deliver that product.
When is the optimum time for a client to come to you with a problem?
Ideally, we are involved before they even design the trial to get FDA approval. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but the major reason for that is, those trials are hideously expensive to perform. And once the trial design is approved, then it's cast in stone. And there are variables or endpoints, clinical endpoints, that are not at all important to the FDA trial, but might be very important with what we do. For instance, I remember a company that produced a spinal device. And unfortunately, the way they designed the trial was a younger population, you know, mostly in their 40s and 50s. And I was at CMS at the time. And when they said, hey, FDA's approved us, how about you guys approving us? Because FDA approves them for marketing and CMS approves them for payment. And we said, how many Medicare age beneficiaries did you have? And it was a few percent. And the decision was, yeah, it seems to work in 40-year-olds, but I don't know if it works in 70-year-olds. If they had talked to somebody like us before they did the FDA trial, I mean, the first thing that we warn companies about is make sure that you get a good racial and age mix, because that's going to be important to the payers. That would be, a good example of the benefit of getting us involved early. Now, we don't have to be super involved at that point. We just like to make sure that we're not missing endpoints in the trial that would be useful later on. And then pretty much, you know, maybe doing some preliminary research, thinking of some strategic decisions. But that's pretty much what we're doing until they get the FDA approval. Then once the FDA approval is received, that's the green light to begin the Medicare process.
From what you're saying, you want, in terms of clinical trial design, you want not only medical professors or researchers or whoever, but you want people who know the reimbursement process. Is that correct?
The FDA's standard is safe and effective. And CMS's statutory threshold for coverage is reasonable and necessary. Those two terms are not the same. And so what is definitely safe and effective and therefore approved may not be reasonable. So, you know, you may have a device that works really well, but it actually, you know, works only as well as the previous device, or maybe a device that works really well, but, you know, it only works for children or something like that. And so in that case, obviously, from Medicare standpoint, it would not be reasonable because it only works on children. So there are endpoints that are going to be very useful later on when we're talking to CMS and even when you're marketing the product, which you could easily capture because you're following these patients very closely because they're part of your trial. And it doesn't really cost anything to add 6 or 7 more data points to your data collection tool. But if you finish the trial and then wish you'd done it, all that money is wasted, at least from the perspective of the one data point that you would have found very useful.
You mentioned the phrase educating CMS, that part of what applied policy does is to educate CMS. How does that process look? Clearly, you don't just walk into their office and say, look, you're wrong and we're right.
CMS has very little flexibility. I used to say when I was teaching health policy, CMS is the only insurance company that's run by Congress. And so much of what CMS has done is bound by their statutory responsibilities. For instance, for years and years and years, CMS could not pay for colonoscopy because the threshold for coverage was reasonable and necessary for the diagnosis or treatment of disease or illness or to improve the functioning of a malformed body member. So screening tests were, by law, not legal for CMS to pay for. Doesn't make any sense, but it was the law.
You said before that you like working with younger people, that that's very healthy and invigorating and inspiring for you. Sounds like you have a great team at Applied Policy that you work with and depend on all levels.
I wouldn't change a thing as far as the people I work with or the kind of work that we're doing. It's great. I practiced emergency medicine for more than 40 years, almost 50 years, and I loved the medicine and I loved the teaching. And it really surprised me when I retired clinically last September that I didn't miss it more. And I think part of the reason I don't miss it more is because I'm getting a lot of the same gratification out of what we're doing, although it's completely different. I haven't done CPR in a while.
For the latest developments in health policy and reimbursement issues, please go to our website at appliedpolicy.com. Thank you for listening.